This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And it is Booktown in one form or another, not the form I was quite anticipating. This is Eric Tome. I'm going to be with you till 2 p.m. dealing with bookish matters of one sort or another. I had anticipated spending the first half hour of the program talking with Jean Wachtsuki Houston, well-known author with her husband, James D. Houston, of Farewell to Manzanar, also author of a number of other books, many of them having to do with the same subject, the Japanese relocation, incarceration, imprisonment, whatever you want to call it, at the Manzanar camp east of the Sierras in the California desert. I've tried calling her several times and have not been able to get through to her. She's currently she and her husband, James Houston, are among the staff at the Squaw Valley Community of Writers. And Jean Houston is also going to be the keynote speaker at this summer's Sacramento State Writers Conference, which is going to take place August 10th to 12th. That's this coming weekend. I was going to talk with Jean Wachtsuki Houston about her writing and especially about the things she might be saying to the participants in the conference. Since I haven't been able to get through to her, I think I may just spend some time reading from some of her work. I have two of her books with me. And there'll also be an opportunity at some point for two KVMR listeners to get tickets to the complete Writers' Conference at Sacramento State. It runs for 3 days, Friday evening, then Saturday and Sunday. And a number of the... it runs all day Friday. Excuse me, I was incorrect about that. And they will have some of the writers involved. Some of the better-known ones will be from Francisco A. Alarcón, Mary Mackey, Jean Houston, as I mentioned before, Stephen Kessler, and a number of other people, Rick Foster, and some people not so well-known except in their specific fields. The topics or the workshops will be in children's literature, screenwriting, fiction, nonfiction, playwriting, publishing, poetry, translation, critique, journaling, romance, and free writing exercises. It normally costs a fair amount. I can't quite see the full. It's normally $245 if you'd gotten in before July 21st, $285 after that. And we will have two entrances for two individuals at some time in maybe the next 20 minutes. The next time I get back to that music, I hope you didn't hear too much of. The two major works that Jean Wachtsuki Houston has written, she's written on many essays and stories and many things having to do with other Japanese-American and just plain American topics, but she keeps returning to the topic of Manzanar, the camp where she spent 3 years from 1942 to 1945. Farewell to Manzanar has become sort of the standard description of the subject. It's used in many schools and in many... It's come to be considered something of a young adult book, although it's not actually placed that way in the Nevada County Library, and it certainly has plenty to offer for adults as well. But when she came back, she wrote that in the 1970s, and then in 2003 published The Legend of Fire Horse Woman. And this is clearly something very close to her heart, because her email address has Fire Horse Woman in it. But in any case, this is a book that also returns to Manzanar, in a sense. There are three characters involved. One is a grandmother, Sayo, who is the Wind Horse Woman of the title. Then her daughter, Hana, and then Hana's daughter, who is known in Japanese as Teruko, in American formerly as Teresa, but usually called Terry by everybody in the family. The book involves about an equal amount of narrative from the 1940s, from the actual events of Manzanar, and from much earlier, from around 1903 for the most part, 1902 and 1903 in Hiroshima. That's where it begins. That's where Sayo, who had grown up in the Japanese mountains, was living when her aunt, who had taken her in, arranged a marriage for her with a young man who had recently, Japanese, who had moved to America. His father was a wealthy sake factory owner, and the story was that the son in America was starting his own, in this case, soy sauce factory, and was going to be a very wealthy man. It turns out that was not exactly the case. I'm going to read just from the very beginning of it, maybe a little bit from the first section from 1902 and then the first section from 1942. And the first section from 1902 is just labeled Matchmakers, Hiroshima, Japan, 1902. Go-between sat in the small hut of the seamstress, sipping tea with polite slurps. Flattered to be acting as a matchmaker for the prominent Matsubara, he was more than curious to glimpse the beautiful Sayo, whose comeliness sparked both lust and envy in the hearts of villagers throughout the countryside. As you know, Matsubara Tadanoshin is looking for a wife for his son Hiroshi in America. He is the second son, but Matsubara is treating him like the eldest because he feels he is starting a new family line across the ocean. Go-between was letting seamstress know Matsubara was not following the tradition where the oldest son inherited everything. The second son would be a good catch, too. Purposefully sitting so she faced the family shrine on the Takonoma, seamstress poured another cup of tea for her guest. Hi. I know about Matsubara's guest. Everyone in this village and miles around knows. Then you must be aware why I am here to see you. Hi. I am in fact honored and pleased for my niece Sayo. Her directness opened the way for discussion, prompting Go-between to proudly report the Matsubara background, their samurai lineage, and impressive holdings. His feigned humility did not escape seamstress's keen eye. She could use to her advantage his need to vicariously identify with the Matsubara. Hiroshi is doing quite well in America. He hopes to start a shoyu, that's soy sauce, manufacturing business there someday. He produced a picture of the serious-faced young man, clean-shaven with thick black hair slicked down on a narrow head. Hiroshi stared out from the photograph, large oval eyes fixed on seamstress's face. An uneasiness swept over her. She felt sadness emanating from these eyes, pleading with her for what she knew not. Unnerved, she glanced over at the shrine. Did she catch a glint of light flickering off the gold filigree? He's 32 years old, born in the second year of the Meiji, Go-between said. Again, seamstress looked at the shrine, the only ornate fixture in the small, bare hut. Where was a sign? She needed a sign, an omen, to guide her next move. Should she go forward with the carefully made-up background for Sayo? Go-between smiled, gapped yellow teeth glistening from the tea. He coughed lightly. Seamstress could see he was trying to fill the moment of silence with sound, any sound. A brisk wind rushed through the open partition of the front porch, knocking over a small vase on the tachonoma. She drew in a deep breath, trembling with the knowledge her dead brother's spirit had spoken. Veiling eyes with politeness, she began to recite Sayo's history. Aha, what good coincidence. He was born in the year of the snake, no? Sayo was 22, born in the 11th hour of the Meiji. Makes her 10 years younger than Hiroshi. A good age span, don't you think? Go-between's face did not register any questions upon hearing Sayo's age. He had heard rumors she was older, that she was 24 or even 26. Gossip abounded about this beauty, but nothing negative had been uncovered from his early investigation. The peasant's logic was that since she was unmarried, she must be unmarriageable, and although no one remembered any attempts or failures in setting up a match, stories flew that secret inquiries had uncovered serious flaws. Insanity tainted her family. She was the mistress of a high-placed official. She suffered from the dreaded inheritable tuberculosis. Encouraged by Go-between's attentive gaze, seamstress continued. As you know, my niece is an orphan, the only daughter of my older brother. He was a fisherman who was lost at sea. His wife died soon after from grief. She forced a tear and let it slide down her cheek before wiping it away with a kimono sleeve. The second lie came more easily. After all, an accidental death while working was more honorable than having been the victim of a catastrophe caused by carelessness. It was respectable for the sea gods to have claimed her brother, not the raging inferno sparked by a glowing cinder left undampered in the kitchen fire and fanned by a turbulent wind sweeping down the mountains. A smoking ash heap was all that remained of her brother, his wife, and son, and their small hut in the northern snow country. Sayo was the only survivor. Protected by the gods, she was visiting seamstress when tragedy struck. Go-between need not know about the fire. People would wonder why the family deserved such ill fate. Sayo's past must not be tainted with any bad karma. My niece is adept at sewing. I am a seamstress, and she has been with me since she was a child. I have tried to raise her as my own daughter. She is quiet, but not timid. Does Hiroshi-san have a forceful nature? Blinking, Go-between hesitated for one telling moment. He realized he knew nothing of Hiroshi's personality. Why hadn't he asked Matsubara? Biding for time to think of some profound and distinctive quality, he slurped his tea noisily, then studied the leaves at the cup's bottom, as if modesty prevented him from exalting Hiroshi too profusely. He cleared his throat. Yes, Hiroshi-san is very strong. In fact, he is quite a leader, would have become some military officer had he remained in Japan. Unlike most second-born sons, he has a mind of his own and is independent. He guessed she wanted to hear that. Who cared if it was not true? They would be far away in America. No one to blame, especially Go-between, humble saltmaker, chosen by the illustrious Matsubara to acquire a wife for his son. Enjoying the thought of not being held accountable, he began to elaborate. He is also quite poetic and scholarly, and a very able painter. I understand he is learning the Gaijin's language and even knows how to drive those machines. She nodded, allowing eyes to widen in amazement. Ah, so they will get along. Sayo wrote poetry and even knows how to read and write. She didn't have to make this up about her niece. Even as a small child, Sayo had shown a curiosity for literary things, begging to learn how to read. It was fortunate her friend, the old retired geisha from Kyoto, had taken an interest in the lively orphan, teaching her to read and write, enchanting her with kabuki stories, even instructing her to play the shamisen and to sing. As for her health, my niece is in excellent condition. No insanity or TB in the family, and no history of barrenness. Relieved by the agreeable way in which the discussion was progressing, the matchmaker relaxed and let their imaginations and tongues roam wild with fabricated backgrounds for the young couple. They indulged themselves with fanciful talk, realizing there would be no checking up or further investigation. Free to create the perfect match, they projected upon the principals all those attributes and talents they wished had been their own. When Go-Between stood up to leave, the atmosphere was jovial and light. The empty teapot might just as well have been a spent cask of sake. Now, what did you say Sayo-chan's sign is? He was already referring to the bride-elect in a familiar way. I believe she is a rabbit, seamstress lied. The snake and rabbit are a good match. This union must be blessed by the gods. She was beginning to believe the new background she had created for her niece. Please convey to Matsubara-san my delight in uniting our families with this marriage. I know my brother and his wife, who now look down on us from the river of souls in the clouds, are truly honored. Go-Between bowed deeply, trying to imitate Matsubara's authoritative style. Excellent, he said, and stepped outside the tiny hut. He hesitated for one moment, wishing Sayo would arrange so he might glimpse the famed beauty at close range. But his wish was not to be granted that day. He took leave of seamstress, his disappointment soon replaced with the anticipation of attending the wedding, which surely would be the most talked-about event for years to come. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I had anticipated talking with Jean Waksaki Houston today. She's the author, with her husband James Houston, of Farewell to Manzanar and the more recent novel, The Legend of Fire Horse Woman, which also takes place partly at Manzanar and goes into much greater detail about early 20th century Japanese American life. She's going to be the keynote speaker at the Sacramento State Summer Writers Conference this Friday through Sunday. And in a few minutes, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, we'll give an opportunity for several listeners to get free entrance to the conference. Since I wasn't able to talk to her, since I called her several times and didn't get through, I'm going to go on with the second chapter of The Legend of Fire Horse Woman. This is called Teruko, which is the Japanese name of the youngest member of the three women who are the central characters in the novel. And this is Teruko, Manzanar, California, 1942. Terry waits in line for the typhoid shot. She never has had an injection and dreads the needle, silk thread thin, poised to penetrate upper arms of internees before her. The mysterious fluid forces screams from children and causes adults to squint their eyes. She leans back against Obachan, finding comfort in the incense smell always emanating from her grandmother's kimono. And her grandmother is Sayo, who we heard about in the first chapter. Obachan's musky smell, pine forests, mushrooms, ancient moss, a damp smell that cools the dust-laden desert air. Don't look at the needle, Obasan says in Japanese. Turn your face away and think of its bite as an insect's kiss. Her arms drape around Terry's neck, long cotton sleeves flowing down over her granddaughter's thin chest, where developing breasts rise the kimono's circular pattern into two small mounds. Why do we need to get these shots? Asked Terry in English. I heard they make you sick. Sayo understands the American language, but rarely speaks it. What she does not do well, she refuses to do at all. She would rather appear mute than foolish, and thus refrains from speaking pidgin. The sing-song half-English most elders in camp speak. Terry honors this. Even though she hated learning the language when she was younger, she is now grateful for the closeness to her grandmother that comes with understanding Japanese. Like the silky sound of water trickling over worn rocks, Obachan's voice smooths the barbed edges of the unknown. We won't get sick, says Obachan. I have some good herbs I brought from home. As the line inches forward, Terry keeps her face averted from the white cloth-covered table where two young internee volunteers are jabbing waiting arms. Exposed and vulnerable, the naked flesh surrenders to the needle's swift violation. Swab, prick, swab. Terry smells alcohol wafting up from the cotton and needle trays. She chances a glance at her torturer and sees lidless snake eyes gleaming from a smooth, impassive face. Unlined is a mochi mooncake, thin lips creased in a downward curve. With horror, she watches the needle approach, unable to look away from its piercing attack. Bing! Surprised, she feels no pain, only a strange tickle, as if a feather had gently bruised against her. Only when cotton is pressed against the puncture does she feel a slight burning. "Next," the volunteer says, thin lips cracking open. She watches Obachan roll up her kimono sleeve, slowly and deliberately, undaunted by the young woman's coldness. Obachan turns, lowering her eyes. With one arm extended and face tilted, she looks like a dancer in the musical stories she teaches. Terry imagines her grandmother fluttering a gold gilt fan against her cheek and hears shamisen music plinking in the background. With a stamp of her foot, Obachan commands flower petals to shower down from the yellow sky. Like purple snow, blossoms float over them, overcoming the sharp medicinal smell with a sweet plum fragrance. They leave the mess hall area. Terry's arm now aches, and she holds it tightly with her other hand. The afternoon wind has begun to blow, churning up gusts of sand that prickle her face as they walk toward their barrack. Obachan glides beside her, wooden gaitas skimming over the gravelly dirt road. She is slim and willowy, pliantly bending like a marsh reed in the wind. It is hard to believe she is 64, a fact that gives Terry great pleasure whenever she has the chance to reveal it and witness the widened eyes of disbelief. Obachan is tall for a Japanese woman with skin the color and texture of unblemished ivory. Always erect, her back as strong and straight as a temple spire, she looks taller than she is and commands respect wherever she goes. Terry has seen even the haughtiest of persons, such as the block manager, shrivel in deference before her. Terry is sometimes embarrassed watching reactions to her grandmother, such as suspicious glances from women, especially wives of the Issei, the first-generation immigrants who had avoided the federal prisons and were interned in camps with their families. Issei men seem to like Obachan and treated her differently than other women, even their own wives. Terry remembers the incident with Mr. and Mrs. Tani, who live in the barracks next door, when they first came to camp. Arriving earlier, Terry's family eagerly had awaited the new neighbors, hoping they would be from Los Angeles and would bring some word from the outside. But they came from Bainbridge, near Seattle, and had no news except to say the train trip was very long and their daughters threw up continuously from Washington State to California. A few days later, Mrs. Tani, who looks about Obachan's age, but is probably younger, was struggling to lift a roll of linoleum given by the authorities for covering the splintery wooden floors. Old man Tani in his shiny black boots stood and watched with gnarled hands on hips. Obachan, who had been observing discreetly from her small cubicle, floated over, kimono sleeves flapping like sails. Passing Tani-san without a glance, she offered to help Mrs. Tani. Rubber Boots, unaware he had been spied on, seemed shaken by her appearance. He began berating his wife, shouting, "Baka, you're such a slow-witted donkey," while she and Obachan stood holding the heavy linoleum roll between them. Tears welled up in Mrs. Tani's eyes, and her face turned as red as the crimson lacquered bowl Obachan keeps before her shrine. Still, Rubber Boots refrained from offering a hand. Then, just as Terry began walking over to help, she saw her grandmother swing her end of the roll like a giant baseball bat and smash it down with great force on Tani-san's oversized boot. She wheeled around, grabbing Terry's hand, and pulled her back to their barracks. Terry knew her grandmother was furious, slamming the door shut and causing plank walls to shake as if an earthquake had struck. She noticed her grandmother's face was pale, and her hand trembled as she brushed a gray wisp of hair from her forehead. Remaining silent, Terry sat on the floor. She knew better than to draw attention to herself until her grandmother had recovered her poise. She sat with legs folded beneath the buttocks, as she had been taught to do, to sit in calm repose for hours until her legs turned to wood. Finally, Obachan spoke. "Teruko-chan, you must promise something." The Japanese words tinkled like wind charms. But Terry knew the chimes could change in an instant into clashing steel gongs, ringing with a resonance that could topple temples. She had witnessed enough of her grandmother's unpredictable explosions to know the unruffled exterior was an illusion, not so much deception as powerful strategy. Dazed, some of Obachan's challengers never knew what hit them. "Yes, I promise. Never, never allow a man to speak to you like that. Allowing the words to float between them, Terry had not answered immediately. She knew Obuchan considered silence between words more important than the words themselves. Why was old Rubber Boots cursing his wife? She finally asked. What made him so mad? I humiliated him, but he couldn't attack me, so he cursed his wife. She smiled slyly. I don't think he expected some smashed toes. How come Mrs. Tani lets him talk to her like that? She was acting like she did something wrong.
She did. She allowed him to treat her like a dog.
Then Terry felt her grandmother's intense eyes, jet black, piercing, drawing out some reflection from her own, a reflection she herself had not known was there. Pulled by surging currents into this mysterious and bottomless underwater world, Terry tried to enter Obachan's vision, but she only perceived two shiny abalone pendants where her grandmother's eyes should have been. Remember, Rubber Boots is not a man.
A big man, Obuchan said. He needs those boots to hold him up.
She began to chuckle. He needs those boots because his feet are so small they would poke holes in the ground when he walks. No longer able to hold back laughter, she fell over on her side, covering her face with a kimono sleeve. Terry laughed uproariously, imagining Tani-san sinking into the ground with each step, two rubber pegs, peg legs stabbing and thrusting as he waded through the earth. Terry learned early that Obuchan's lessons, especially the serious ones, ended with images so crazily humorous they seemed to make no sense. But she long since has given up trying to interpret her grandmother's visions. Living with open mind, she anticipates the endings, as if they were punchlines of good jokes, not deep admonitions carved in stone. And almost always, they both end up laughing so hard that Terry rarely forgets what Obuchan really is teaching in her own unusual way. That's the first part of the second chapter of Jean Waxies Houston's The Legend of Fire Horse Woman. And it covers the lives of three Japanese-American women from 1902 into the 1940s, from leaving Japan to being interned at the Manzanar camp during World War II. I had hoped to speak with Jean Houston this afternoon, but our connection did not go through. I hope you've enjoyed those sections of her novel. I think it's a wonderful writing and gives a excellent introduction to Japanese American life, to Japanese life and to American life, all things rolled together. She is going to be the keynote speaker at the Sacramento State Summer Writers Conference this coming weekend, and I've got a couple of entries for that for two people. I think I will pick the second and fifth listeners who call in at 530-265-9555 as soon as the music begins. That's 265-9555 if you're interested in a free pass to the Sacramento State Summer Writers Conference.
This is Booktown on KPMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be here till 2 o'clock. A number of things have not worked quite as well as I had hoped this afternoon. I was not able to talk with Gene Wachotsky Houston as I had hoped. Instead, I read from her book, The Legend of Fire Horse Woman, and I only received one person who wanted a ticket or entry to the Sacramento State Summer Writers Conference. I might try it again in a few minutes, but I think you've heard an awful lot of that music this afternoon. Today is a strange day in many ways. It's the novel I just read from begins in Hiroshima, and it was Hiroshima that the United States dropped an atomic bomb on 72 years ago. I've often thought about this because I was 51 days old at that time, and nobody asked me if it was a good idea. If they had, I surely would have told them no. But nobody did, and I guess there's no cause for regret, but that's a precedent that hangs over us and probably will, maybe as long as humans are around. We can hope it'll never happen again, but we cannot be sure. It was also strangely the birth date of Alfred Lord Tennyson, who W.H. Auden once described as having the best ear of any English poet, but probably also being the stupidest. One of the people Tennyson hated most was Ben Jonson. He said reading him was wading through glue. He died on this day in the early 1600s. Andy Warhol was born on this day as well, and a number of other people as well came and went. And in this last week, the United States appointed a new poet laureate, a somewhat high-sounding title. It was, for many years, the post was called poetry consultant or consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress, and it's been held by many distinguished American poets since 1942. The new, and you know, I think it was in 1995 that they changed the title to Poet Laureate, I guess to give it a little more class. The new Poet Laureate is Charles Simic, who was born in Yugoslavia in before World War II, I believe in 38, and moved to the United States with his mother when he was 15. He's written a number of books of poems, essays, and quite a few translations from Central European languages. His poems are usually short, witty, ironic, just observations on things he sees about him. I doubt that any that I've read are more than a page or two, and many of them are only about 10 lines. And I'm hoping to play a few of these and hoping that we'll see how well technology is working today. It has not been working entirely to my pleasure up to now. Let's give this a try. The first one we're going to try is Charles Simic reading the poem called The Fork.
Fork. This strange thing must have crept right out of hell. It resembles a bird's foot worn around a cannibal's neck. As you hold it in your hand, as you stab with it into a piece of meat, it is possible to imagine the rest of the bird. Its head, which like your fist, is large, bold, beakless, and blind.
Now that I know that works, I'm going to try a couple of others. In the next couple of minutes, we're going to hear a few more things from Charles Simic, the current American Poet Laureate. The next one is called The Clocks of the Dead.
The Clocks of the Dead. One night I went to keep the clock company. It had a loud tick after midnight, as if it were uncommonly afraid. It's like whistling past a graveyard, I explained. In any case, I told him I understood. Once there were clocks like that in every kitchen in America. Now the factory's windows are all broken. The old man and night shift are in Charon's boat. The day you stop, I said to the clock, the little wheels they keep in reserve will have rolled away into many hard-to-find places. Just thinking about it, I forgot to wind the clock. We woke up in the dark. How quiet the city is, I said. Like the clocks of the dead, my wife replied. Grandmother, on the wall, I heard the snows of your childhood begin to fall.
The next one, poem of Charles Simic, is called Cameo Appearance.
Cameo Appearance. I had a small, non-speaking part in a bloody epic. I was one of the bombed and fleeing humanity. In the distance, the great leader crowed like a rooster from a balcony. Or was it a great actor impersonating the great leader? That's me there, I said to the kiddies. I'm squeezed between the man with two bandaged hands raised and the old woman with her mouth open as if she were showing us a tooth. That hurts badly. The 100 times I rewound the tape, not once could they catch sight of me in that huge gray crowd that was like any other gray crowd. Far off to bed, I said finally. I know I was there. One take is all they had time for. We ran, and the planes grazed our hair, and then there were no more, as we stood dazed in the burning city. But of course, they didn't film that.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, bringing you mostly readings this afternoon. I wasn't able to reach Jean Houston as I'd originally hoped, so I read from her work. And now we're listening to the recently appointed United States Poet Laureate Charles Simic reading some of his poems, which, as you can tell, are slight, ironic, wistful, witty, undercutting. I don't know how many other words to throw at them, but let's hear one more. This one's called In the Library.
In the Library. There is a book called A Dictionary of Angels. No one had opened it in 50 years. I know, because when I did, the covers creaked, the pages crumbled. There I discovered the angels were once as plentiful as species of flies. The sky at dusk used to be thick with them. You had to wave both arms just to keep them away. Now the sun is shining through the tall windows. The library is a quiet place. Angels and gods huddled in dark, unopened books. The great secret lies on some shelf Miss Jones passes every day on her rounds. She's very tall, so she keeps her head tipped as if listening. The books are whispering. I hear nothing, but she does.
That was In the Library by the newly appointed United States Poet Laureate Charles Simic. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you for just a few more minutes. I'm going back to that music you may have heard an awful lot of today to give one more person a chance for a free pass to the Sacramento State Summer Writers Conference. This time I will just take the first caller to 530-265-9555. The conference takes place this weekend, all day Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and has workshops and on subjects such as children's literature, screenwriting, fiction, nonfiction, playwriting, publishing, poetry, translation, critique, journaling, romance, and free writing exercises. It normally costs $285, but they are offering a free pass to I'd say, yeah, the first person who calls after this music begins. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and almost out of here. We do have a second person who has called in for a pass to the Sacramento State Summer Writers Conference. So those are both taken. And as I mentioned before, or started to mention, the keynote speakers on this event are Raymond Obstfeld, who I don't know otherwise, but his most recent book is On the Shoulders of Giants, My Journey Through the Harlem Renaissance. He's also written Hungry Women, Borrowed Lives, Lessons in Survival, Dead Heat, and Joker and the Thief. And also Jean Watsky Houston, who is co-author with her husband, James Houston, of Farewell to Manzanar, and more recently of a novel that covers much of the same ground called The Legend of Fire Horse Woman. I read from that during the first half of the program. And an event that's coming up the following week on Saturday, August 18th, is the annual big event for the Nevada County Poetry Series. It's their summer cowboy poetry reading. The readers this time are going to be Harold Roy Miller, Willis Lamb, and Ken Gardner, and it's at 7:30 p.m. On Saturday, August the 18th, at the Center for the Arts in Nevada, in Grass Valley, excuse me. This is usually their biggest fundraiser of the year, and it's always a lot of fun. It probably brings a bigger crowd than almost anything else they do. So that is next Saturday, not this Saturday, but the following Saturday, the 18th, at 7:30 p.m., the Nevada County Poetry Series Cowboy Poetry Evening with Harold Roy Miller, Willis Lamb, and Ken Gardner. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm pretty well talked out by now, having gone through quite a lot of reading, not nearly as much conversation as I would normally like. But that, I guess, is the way it goes. And I'm going to get out of here in just a minute to make way for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party. There's somebody calling. I can't answer the phone just now, but I'll be there in a very short time. So thanks for listening. And 2 weeks from now, I'll be back. And I hope I have somebody besides myself to talk to at that time.